It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Jennifer Griffin. Americans are celebrating the holiday weekend as global strikes and COVID lockdowns threaten to dampen the big shopping season. Workers in dozens of countries protesting or walking off the job amid the Black Friday shopping frenzy as rail unions threaten to do the same, raising the risk of a year-end strike with significant impact on the U.S. economy. This as new COVID lockdowns in China spark worldwide economic fears. We'll discuss what's at stake for U.S. companies. Then the president prepares for big policy fights when Republicans take control of the House in January. Moderate lawmakers hope to seize the moment and break the gridlock to make deals both parties can embrace. We'll ask Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick, the co-chair of the Bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus, what he thinks can get done in a divided government. Plus, early voting underway in parts of Georgia. We'll ask our Sunday panel how a court ruling could impact turnout in this huge race. Then, journalist and author Buzz Bissinger joins me to talk about the Mosquito Bowl, a hard-fought football game between two Marine regiments on Christmas Eve, 1944. We'll discuss what happened to the players in the deadly conflict that followed. Also,
kind of lifted our morale and reassured us that folks at home were working on it.
The story of a single bracelet that became a movement of millions to support America's POWs. All right now on Fox News Sunday. And hello from Fox News in Washington. I'm Jennifer Griffin, in for Shannon Bream. Major economic concerns on a global scale, just as many Americans wrapped up Black Friday shopping and prepare for Cyber Monday. Protests at the world's largest iPhone factory in central China over COVID lockdowns. Amazon workers taking to the streets in dozens of countries as American railroad workers are poised to do the same here at home if a new labor deal is not quickly reached. In a moment, we'll be joined by Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, a member of the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. But first, let's turn to Lucas Tomlinson, live in Nantucket, Massachusetts, where the president is spending the holiday weekend. Lucas?
Jen, President Biden has spent the last few days relaxing on this little island. But even while shopping yesterday here in town on Small Business Saturday, he could not escape questions about 2024.
Mr. President, how are your 2024 conversations going?
We're not having any. We're celebrating.
Nationwide, a massive railroad strike looms, with the potential to cripple the transportation of a third of all goods in the United States. After Biden took credit for averting a strike back in September, this time he says he's taking a more hands-off approach.
My team has been in touch with all the parties and in rooms with the parties, and I have not directly engaged yet because they're still talking.
Just days before, Biden's press secretary said the opposite.
The president is indeed involved directly, but I don't want to get into details at this time, but he has been involved. I just said the president has been directly involved. He's been in touch. This is the third time I'm saying he's been directly involved.
It's not just trains that could ground to a halt, but Amazon packages as well. After thousands of Amazon workers around the world walked out on the job on one of the busiest shopping days of the year, citing low pay and poor working conditions. Protesters also taking to the streets in China, rejecting what they call onerous lockdowns under China's oppressive COVID zero policy. The violence extending to what is known as iPhone City after 200,000 workers were forced into isolation in trash-filled dorms.
Yesterday, the U.S. Treasury Department announced it would allow Chevron to resume oil production in Venezuela in an apparent bid to lower gas prices. Jen?
Lucas Tomlinson, traveling with the president in Nantucket. Lucas, thank you. Joining us now is Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick, co-chief of the Problem Solvers Caucus, a bipartisan group of 58 lawmakers. Welcome to Fox News Sunday.
Good to be with you, Jennifer.
Good to be with you. Congressman Fitzpatrick, the White House says the decision to allow Chevron to start pumping oil in Venezuela is not about oil prices. Do you believe them?
I do not, Jennifer. The energy crisis that we're facing right now in America, much of that has been self-imposed by decisions that were made by this administration early on to shut down the Keystone XL pipeline, further delaying the permitting process here domestically. I don't know why we're going to communist dictatorships. We're begging OPEC Plus to increase production when we have the energy right here in America to get the job done.
Staying with the economy, we're facing a possible nationwide rail strike, as Lucas reported. A strike would disrupt the supply chain again, cost $2 billion a day, cost 700,000 jobs if it lasts a month. Materials needed by refineries won't be transported. Gas prices would go up. This is a big problem for the president. Does Congress need to step in?
Well, that would be the last resort, Jennifer. So we're set to leave Congress on December 15th. The cooling off period for this this negotiation is set down a few days before Christmas. The union members have a very reasonable ask, by the way. Their benefits have not been on par. That is the Transit Freight Workers Union have not been on par with other unions. They haven't had a raise in several years. And one-third of the product, Jennifer, in the United States is transported by freight rail, including close to 70% of our agricultural, you know, grains, feeds, fertilizer, and the like. So congressional intervention is a last resort. I suspect that after we pass the CR near December 15th, if that strike has not been averted, we'll be called back before Christmas.
And what do you think the truth is? Is the president involved in these negotiations, or are they waiting until the last minute like they did in September?
I believe he's involved. I mean, this is something that would be of significant concern, you know, economic concern and certainly therefore political concern for the administration. So I'm sure they're involved. They're probably, you know, waiting until the right time to reengage. Like I said, it'll be a few days before Christmas before this actually manifests. But Congress will not let this strike happen, that's for sure. It would be devastating to our economy, so we'll get to a resolution one way or another.
And Republicans will support the president if he agrees with the railroad workers?
Well, I certainly would. I mean, every member of Congress has got to speak for themselves, but failure is not an option here. We cannot have our transportation system responsible for one-third of our products being transported throughout our country shut down. That's not an option.
Congressman Fitzpatrick, you're a former FBI agent. There have been 600 mass shootings this year. The president says he will pursue an assault rifle ban. Will you work with him?
We all need to work together, Jennifer, to end gun violence in America. The reality is that we have an epidemic here in the United States that's not being experienced in any other country in the world. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I think people try to oversimplify the problem. The key is to make sure that every single tragedy gets unpacked and figure out what the problem is with that individual tragedy. I know we've had an issue with the background check system with Charleston. We had an issue with the mental health system with Uvalde. And there's societal problems as well. We have spikes in depression and anxiety rates amongst our children throughout America, largely due to social media. Jennifer, when you and I grew up, if there was bullying going on in school, you could identify the bullier, number one. And number two, the bullying ended at 3 o'clock when you left school. Now the bulliers are anonymous. Social media allows that bullying to occur 24 hours a day. So we have to fix the loopholes in our background check system. We have to fix our broken mental health system in America. And we have to deal with the societal impacts of social media. It's a very complicated problem that requires a complicated solution.
But would you support an assault rifle ban?
Well, I voted for it, Jennifer. It's already come up in the House several months back. So that's sitting in the Senate, and that's where it resides right now.
There's talk of more red flag laws, which allow authorities to temporarily confiscate firearms if the person is a threat to themselves or others. You're one of five Republican House members who voted for a federal red flag law this summer, and you're the only one of the five who ran for re-election. Should the Republican Party support red flag laws? Are you noticing any shift among your colleagues?
Yeah, so it depends on how it's written, Jennifer. So, for example, the state of Indiana, Republican House, Republican Senate, Republican governor signed a similar bill like that into law. In Florida, same situation after Parkland, Republican House, Republican Senate, Governor Rick Scott at the time, Republican governor, signed it into law. And a Republican governor now, Rick DeSantis, has kept that law in the book. So there are ways you can write it where it preserves due process, protects law-abiding gun owners' rights, but at the same time, advances community safety. Because, like I said, with every single one of these tragedies, whether it be Parkland or Uvalde or Chesapeake, Virginia, or any of these, it's incumbent upon us to analyze the situation. Where were the gaps? Was it a gap in the mental health system? Was it a HIPAA reporting issue? Was it a loophole in the background checks? Or was it something different?
Is Kevin McCarthy going to be the next Speaker of the House?
I believe he is. You know, I've been in touch with his team. We're working conference-wide to try to get him to 218, Jennifer. And the reality is he's earned it. He deserves it. It would set a terrible precedent if he were not to get it, because Kevin has put 4 years' worth of work, 4 years' worth of fundraising, traveling across the country, visiting all of our congressional districts. He's worked hard. He's accomplished the goal, albeit a slim one, of winning back the House majority. And he deserves it. And I don't believe there's anyone else in our conference that could get to 218. So I think eventually we're going to get there.
Okay. Thank you very much, Congressman Fitzpatrick, for being with us today. Thanks for being with us this holiday weekend. Up next, early voting underway in Georgia's Senate runoff. We'll bring in our Sunday group to discuss the race that will determine if the Senate stays 50-50 or if Democrats can expand their narrow majority.
When you get a chip in your windshield,
listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The White House on a serious collision path with organized labor as a national rail strike looms and could hit Americans and disrupt supply chains right in the middle of the holiday season. And it's time now for our Sunday group. Politico congressional reporter Olivia Beavers, retired senior CIA station chief and Fox News contributor Dan Hoffman, Fox News senior political analyst Juan Williams, and Axios national political correspondent Jonathan Swan. Juan, organized labor is normally friendly to President Biden and Democrats, but the risk of a nationwide rail strike now is very real. It could impact everything from what we see on grocery store shelves to prices at the pump to supplies that keep our water safe. The president helped avert the crisis back in September, but the tentative deal that was reached runs out on December 9th. Is it time for the president to step into the negotiations? Time is running out, it seems.
Well, I think that what you have now is Labor Secretary Marty Walsh, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg in touch with both sides. The president's approach is, I'm going to try to ameliorate potential impact on American families and the economy for now. And so he's saving his intervention. Now, the reason for that, Jen, is very interesting. The unions don't want the Congress and the president to intervene. 92, the last time there was a strike, the strike was over in 2 days because Congress and the president intervened. So for now, both sides really want the pressure, the deadline drama. They think it helps them at the bargaining table. The railroad companies in this country are very profitable operations. In the September deal, they gave a 24% over 5-year deal increase in pay to the unions, and they think that's a generous offer. The unions, on the other hand, the trainmen, the engineers have approved that deal, but the rest of the other unions said no. Why? Because of benefits. And you just talked about this with Congressman Fitzpatrick. What you get is that the big railroad companies have not approved sick pay, sick days. and the unions say, hey, we need 15 sick days. This job is too demanding, and we need some flexibility in terms of shifts. And so right now, the big companies have refused to reopen the talk about benefits, and the unions say, unless you do that, we don't have a deal. So the deadline pressure is something both sides see as helping to force a deal.
But you think they'll get a deal?
Well, I think, you know, it's inevitable because the impact. It's not going to cancel Christmas, thank goodness, but, the supplies are on the shelves. But this is something that could impact the entire nation's economy, and you can't have that.
Jonathan, now to Donald Trump and his third run for the White House. Are you surprised by the number of prominent Republicans who have come out against Trump? Even as Attorney General Bill Barr writes, Trump will burn down the GOP. Time for new leadership. What's the reaction from Trump advisors to his dining with white nationalist Nick Fuentes at Mar-a-Lago last week?
Well, there actually haven't been that many prominent Republicans who've come out against Trump. And you're even seeing, you know, there's a few. Bill Barr has already condemned Trump before this. You see Chris Christie, he's pretty vocal. But even you look at people like Mike Pompeo, Trump's former Secretary of State, he's criticizing Trump without naming Trump, which tells me, and Pence sort of is being kind of gentle as well, which tells me that there is still a fear among Republicans, even ones who want to oppose him potentially in 2024, that Trump still commands a serious, meaningful proportion of the base, and they don't want to cross him yet. DeSantis, for example, has been completely silent. Nick Fuentes, to your question, one of the most virulent anti-Semites and just open racists, Holocaust denier, you know, you just go through his clips, it's kind of staggering to listen to. Trump's advisors, you know, most of his core team right now have been through, you know, Charlottesville, Access Hollywood, you know, go through the list. This is sort of another day in the life of. They don't run around lighting their hair on fire. I sort of see some people say, oh, they're all freaking out. That wasn't been my experience the last few days of talking to them. These are people who've, you know, it's sort of just another day at the office, actually. And one person said to me, and I saw someone else sort of tweeted this, but basically their take was, and this is a Republican official, was he invites one notorious anti-Semite to dinner, Kanye West, and he shows up with another notorious anti-Semite. So, you know, the surprise was that there was two rather than one.
But it's doubling. That should be cause for concern.
Yeah,
for
two
people.
Is worse than one, yeah.
All right, Olivia, early voting is now underway in parts of Georgia. Obviously, there's a December 6th runoff between Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock and Republican Herschel Walker. It will decide whether Democrats have 50 or 51 seats. What are you seeing?
Well, you know, right now the polls suggest that it's just as close as it was when we were watching earlier during the midterms. There were 35,000 votes that separated Warnock and Walker, and right now Warnock seems to have the edge, but give and take the margin of error. Abortion seemed to play a pretty large role in motivating Democrats to turn out, and now with sort of early voting, it's sort of an area where Democrats are really pushing that space, so we're going to see how this plays out, but...
Well, it's interesting you should mention that because Georgia's Supreme Court reinstated the state's ban on abortions after roughly 6 weeks. Do you think abortion will continue to play an issue down there?
I'm sure that that's going to be definitely, you know, motivating people. There's more support for something that's more like a 15-week ban, but, you know, Democrats are saying that this was a bigger issue, and the polling, the exit poll seems to suggest more so.
Dan, as we speak, NATO ally Turkey is planning to carry out a ground invasion into Syria. They're targeting the very Kurdish groups that the U.S. relies on to fight ISIS. I spoke to the head of the SDF, the Kurdish leader, who said he had to put a pause in working with the U.S. again. You know, they were guarding 10,000 ISIS prisoners. Here's what he said just earlier this week.
All of our forces have to be on the border and borders and the front lines, thinking about protecting our people. So we had to stop this activities alongside the international coalition. We had no choice.
What does this mean for the region and for U.S. troops based there? Are there about 1,000 troops there?
A Turkish incursion would have a significantly negative impact on our ongoing fight against ISIS. We've been allied with the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurds. going back almost a decade to 2014. They're also guarding the Al Hol refugee camp where there are tens of thousands of terrorists, and they simply can't do it all at once. I expect that there are ongoing back-channel discussions with Turkey. Turkey has a lot of leverage because they control new NATO membership for Finland and Sweden. And I'm sure we're making the point that a Turkish attack on these Kurds would impact Turkey as well, because the terrorists would have a lot of open field running potentially back into Turkey.
But a big issue for the president, one of the many national security threats that he is facing right now. Thank you very much, panel. Up next, during one of the most divisive times in world history, two World War II Marine regiments came together for a game of football before being sent to one of the bloodiest battles in the Pacific. We sit down with author Buzz Bissinger of Friday Night Lights fame to share the story of the Mosquito Bowl and what happened next.
What if...
The winter of 1944 was different for many Americans. World War II was raging across Europe and in the South Pacific, and millions of servicemen spent the holiday season in unfamiliar lands. Many spent time stationed on the island of Guadalcanal, once a stronghold for the Japanese army, conquered by U.S. forces and used as a staging point for future offensives. But on Christmas Eve, conflict ceased for a moment, and the Marines marked the holiday by playing in the Mosquito Bowl, a bruising and bloody football game born from trash talk and intense rivalry between two different Marine regiments. The teams were stocked with former college players, including several All-Americans. 16 players were even drafted into the pros. 6 months later, those who played in the game also fought in the Battle of Okinawa, one of the bloodiest of the war. The story of the game and the events that followed are detailed in The Mosquito Bowl, a game of life and death in World War II. The newly released book is dedicated to Neil McCallum, a Marine who was on the sidelines of the dirt and coral field.
I was a participant drinking beer, hot beer, at that game.
94-year-old McCallum spoke with me from his home in Tampa, Florida.
The war in Europe got more attention than we did, and they got more of everything than we did. My only aim in all of this is to keep our legacy going for the 6th Marine Division and for all the men that we lost.
Joining me now, the author of The Mosquito Bowl, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Buzz Bissinger, best known for his nonfiction account of Friday Night Lights. Buzz, this is a great book.
Well, thank you.
Great book.
Thank you.
Americans are preparing to watch a lot of football today. Why did you choose to write about this particular game?
Well, when I heard about it, I was sort of floored. The idea of a football game on the island of Guadalcanal in the Pacific on Christmas Eve of 1944, and a real game, as close as they could get. You know, they built goalposts, they built a regulation field, PA system, programs. I said, God, this is, and 1,500 Marines came, and I said, this is incredible. But I realized they weren't men who played, they were boys. They were still boys. They were young, they were inexperienced, and now they're in war where you lose your boyhood very quickly. The game was a way of being boys again. And the upshot was they had a blast, 1,500 Marines, as I said. The upshot was of the 65 who played in that game, 15 were later killed several months later at Okinawa. And then I said, I think there's a book if I can get at the reporting.
And yet it was more than a game. As you mentioned, 65 Marines suited up. It was broadcast on Armed Forces Network across the Pacific. There were 1,500 Marines on the sidelines. They took a break from training. Half of them would not survive. That kind of statistic we can't really fathom. What happened during the game, and why was it Marines who were doing this and so many college players? I think it was the most college athletes or athletes to ever die in a battle.
Football players gravitated towards the Marine Corps, which makes sense. You know, they're macho, they're tough, they wanted combat. So a lot of these guys, they were in the 4th Regiment and the 29th, were great football players, and they would argue with one another who has the better team, the 4th or the 29th, and they're Marines. So someone finally said, we're Marines. We don't argue. We duke it out. And the game was a way to have joy, to have fun. They beat the crap out of each other. The score was 0-0. And, you know, it was, as I say, it was a way to be boys for the last time.
Which player really stood out to you?
Well, actually, there were several. I mean, David Schreiner, I thought, was amazing. He was a two-time All-American from Wisconsin. He was the perfect All-American. The perfect All-American. He was kind. He was self-effacing. He didn't like publicity. He was handsome. A great, great man. He had a beautiful fiance. I won't say what happened. Maybe you can guess. But he got to me. John McLowry, who went to Brown, got to me. A really cerebral, interesting, intellectual man. Great football player. And, you know, a great illustrator. Inside the inside cover of the book is something he did when he was in the jungle of Bougainville.
And there's a beautiful picture, a family photo from Thanksgiving of the Schreiner family before Dave Schreiner deployed. And we have that photo. The U.S. military was very different then, and so was college football.
College football was the thing. The pros were looked down upon. You know, that's where the thugs go. There's no future in it. College football was huge. That was the game. You know, Notre Dame, Army, Notre Dame, USC, you know, the Big Ten. So if you were a college football star, which many of these guys were, that was a really, really, you know, big deal. But combat was different. You know, it was expected that some of you, you're not going to make it. You're just not going to make it.
But the military recruited from football teams. They thought football teams would make good soldiers and Marines. I thought it was notable that in 1940, there was a Gallup poll taken when many of these young men were graduating, showing 79% of Americans wanted to stay out of the war. Only 2% of college undergraduates believed the U.S. should join the Allies. America was pretty isolationist, but not these players.
No, I mean, in 1940, America was isolationist. There was a feeling that they had been snookered into getting into World War I. They were upset with the British, and they just wanted no part. They would send aid, they would send financial aid, but Americans wanted no part, really, until the bombing of Pearl Harbor. That changed everything, and these guys said, I want a piece of that. I can go. Schreiner could have had a cushy job in the United States. He could have been a phys ed instructor. He said, no, I want to go into combat.
Finally, what was the message from this game regarding the divisions in the country then and that we see in America today?
Well, I think one of the underlying messages is unity. Everybody served. Women served in industry and manufacturing because all the men, you know, were gone. Blacks served despite some withering racism. On the line, you had people from every socioeconomic stripe. And that's when you learn to deal with people, to get along with people, to love people, because they did. And you realize, you know, our differences are really not that different.
Incredible story. I highly recommend it. Buzz, thank you for an amazing American story and joining us this holiday weekend. This Thanksgiving week, I want to share with you another powerful example of Americans coming together, even during one of the most unpopular wars in the nation's history, the Vietnam War. Americans have found common ground. This is the story of one of our colleagues here at Fox who wore a bracelet bearing the name of an American soldier held captive in Vietnam. Decades later, he tracked down the veteran. Here's their story.
As war raged in Vietnam, a quiet effort started by two California sorority sisters to show support for the POW and MIAs who were shot down in rice paddy fields. Many held for years at the Hanoi Hilton took off across America. Students across America began wearing bracelets with the name of an American POW and the date they were shot down. Stars like John Wayne, Princess Grace, and Sonny and Cher wore them. Fox News editor Brad Paxton was one of those kids who sent his $2.50 away to purchase a bracelet.
This is actually a photo of me wearing the bracelet. Yeah, I had lots of hair back then, but
this is 1970.
His bracelet honored Navy Lieutenant Dave Carey, shot down in North Vietnam on August 31st, 1967.
It was just a fad at the time. I'd say 50% of my junior high school was wearing the bracelets. You didn't have to be for the war or against the war. You just could be in support of these people who had been captured.
Spurred by a conversation with his wife about the bracelets and how they united the country during a divisive war, he decided to try to find Lieutenant Dave Carey.
Went down and pulled out a box. I knew right where it was and looked it up. And then, like a lightning bolt, it just kind of like, I should just see whatever happened to this guy.
He found him in Texas, 80 years old, and now an author and motivational speaker. Kerry spent 5.5 years in the Hanoi Hilton, some of it with John McCain, who was shot down a month and a half after him.
I sent him an email and a picture of the bracelet, and to my surprise, within like minutes, he emailed me right back and said, I would love to have it.
I've been getting those periodically for all these years. Someone will find me on the internet, and I'll get an email, and they have a bracelet that they've worn. And then I tell them that they have no idea how much those bracelets meant to us when we were in Hanoi. Those bracelets were incredibly important to us. They kind of lifted our morale.
Kerry, who retired as a captain, can still recall the day he was shot down.
The missile went right between us. There was a huge explosion. Fireball blew the tail section off my airplane. The airplane just stayed on its back. It was just a blur. So this thing is falling and spinning and tumbling through the sky. Ejected from the airplane, had a parachute, landed in the middle of a small North Vietnamese village.
He still remembers the beatings.
I was interrogated. The interrogation led to beatings. The beatings led to torture. My arms didn't work. My arms didn't work for weeks and weeks. I ate by wiggling around in my stomach, stick my face in a bowl of rice. Into my mind came the first line of the 23rd Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." I could think about that line.
They found other tricks to keep their minds intact.
I let slip that I had taken French in high school and at the Naval Academy, and so I immediately became the French teacher. That was French according to me, because there was a lot of stuff I had to make up.
Meanwhile, back in California, the woman who started the bracelet movement, Carol Bates Brown, was a student at Cal State Northridge. She and a girlfriend came up with the MIA POW bracelet concept.
We were able to get materials donated, and somebody came up with the idea of putting names on the bracelets. And when it really took off like it did, it was just shocking and unbelievable. But in all, I think we distributed something like 5 million bracelets during that time.
They were especially popular from 1970 to 1973.
Decided if a kids could pay for a movie, they would pay for a bracelet.
The campaign led to a decades-long career at the Pentagon for Brown at the Defense Intelligence Agency in the Office of POW Missing Personnel. 55 years later, Dave Carey still has the flag airmen carried in their flight suits in case they had to eject.
It says, "I'm a citizen of the United States of America. I do not speak your language. Please take me to someone who provides for my safety and see that I return to my people. My government will reward you."
But when they heard kids back home were wearing bracelets with their names on them, that gave them hope that they had not been forgotten.
We kept our sense of humor and we kept the faith. Faith in ourselves, faith in each other, faith in our country, and faith in God.
I always knew where the bracelet was. I never forgot his name, even 50 years later. I could tell you about Lieutenant David Carey. He's a genuine American hero, and I'm just humbled and to have had a small footnote in his story.
While in captivity, one of the ways this naval aviator kept sane was by pretending to play the piano. After his release, he finally learned to play on a real piano. Today, he still receives mail from kids now grown who wore those bracelets for him and the other POW MIAs.
My message to anyone wearing the uniform of the United States of America would be this. They are way stronger, way more resilient, way more resourceful than they ever would give themselves credit for. They just haven't been tested. There you go.
Our sincere thanks to Brad Paxton, a colleague and dear friend to us here at Fox News Channel's Washington Bureau. It was an honor to share his story and that of Lieutenant Dave Carey. Up next, a deep dive on global threats, the rise of China, and nuclear saber rattling by Russia as President Putin tries to change the map of Europe. This week, French President Emmanuel Macron arrives in Washington for a state dinner and a full plate of global crises to discuss with President Biden. Topics will likely include how the U.S. and Europe will continue to support Ukraine and contain Vladimir Putin. Joining me now, Dmitry Alperovich, a Russian-born American cybersecurity and geopolitics expert who has tracked some of the largest threats facing the U.S. from Russia and China. And Matthew Krenig, the Atlantic Council's acting director of the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. He's one of the world's leading authorities on nuclear weapons. Matthew, Kim Jong-un is seen again with his daughter in tow inspecting ballistic missiles. What should we make of this?
Well, a problem that dictatorships always have is what do you do with succession? And this is a family business. Kim Jong-un's grandfather started the country, his father after him. And so I think Kim Jong-un is probably thinking about a succession plan, and by having his family members, his daughter in these public settings, possibly grooming them for succession. Meanwhile, the nuclear threat continues to grow. North Korea, only the third U.S. adversary other than Russia and China that can threaten nuclear war against the United States. So this is a serious challenge.
How should the U.S. respond to the recent escalation in missile tests from North Korea?
Well, the Biden administration has essentially put this on the back burner. I think they see it as a difficult challenge, so they've prioritized Russia, China, and other issues. But I think that's a mistake. This threat continues to grow. And so I think the right approach is basically a pressure and engagement campaign. Increase the diplomatic, economic, political pressure on North Korea so long as it pursues these destabilizing policies, but hold out the possibility for engagement and negotiations if Kim Jong-un is willing to come talk.
And what's the state of the U.S. nuclear arsenal? Can it still serve as a deterrent?
Well, the U.S. Arsenal is effective today, but it's getting old. It was built in the 70s and the 80s. They're nearing the end of their service lives. And so there is a bipartisan plan to modernize U.S. nuclear weapons over the coming 30 years. But that program has been slipping. We need to make it a priority to make sure that we have a deterrent to protect ourselves and our allies.
Dmitry, what lesson is President Xi taking from Ukraine, and what should we make of these Shanghai protests? Some protesters have even called for Xi to resign, which is unprecedented.
Well, the main lesson he's learning, of course, is that if you're going to go against Taiwan, which I think he wants to do in his lifetime, probably the next 10 years, maybe even sooner, you better be ready. You better make sure that your forces are ready, they're trained, they can execute the mission and hopefully do it quickly from his perspective. The other lesson he may be learning, which may be the incorrect lesson, is that the United States can be deterred via the use of nuclear weapons or the threat of nuclear weapons, because he sees that while we're supporting Ukraine, we have not gone in and helped them with our own troops. That lesson may not apply to Taiwan, but that's what he may be inferring. The protests are really interesting because this is the first time that it seems like President Xi is really losing control over the zero COVID policy that they've had for the last couple of years. The cases are increasing dramatically. There are thousands of new cases a day in Beijing, if we can even believe their numbers. They're probably a lot higher. And the population is fed up. They're not willing to continue to live in lockdowns. And that is going to be very precarious for President Xi going forward.
Also in Taiwan, a pro-China party just won municipal elections. What does this tell you?
Well, this election was a municipal election. It was not about China. But the fact that the population is willing to ignore the Chinese threat and vote for a party that is very friendly to the Beijing government is an indication that the Taiwanese are just not prioritizing the threat. They don't believe it's real. They don't think an invasion is coming. And that has real implications for U.S. policy, because if Taiwan does not shape up, if they don't dramatically increase their conscription, their training, their military industrial complex to produce weapons and to integrate them into their defense forces, Taiwan is going to be in real trouble. And despite what President Biden says about us willing to come to their aid, if the Taiwanese don't fight, Taiwan is going to be doomed.
And they haven't been buying the right type of weapons, from what I understand.
No, they're focused on old-style weapons, tanks, F-16s, that may not be very applicable to a war if the Chinese launch an airborne invasion, for example.
Matthew, the protests in Iran, is this a real threat to the regime? Should the Biden administration be saying more? And is the nuclear deal dead?
Well, you have to really admire the young women in Iran risking their lives standing up to this brutal dictatorship. I do think the Biden administration should be doing more to support them, both verbally and behind the scenes. Unfortunately, the sad reality when we've seen this before is that the regime is willing to kill in large numbers to stay in power. The Iranians haven't been willing to die in large enough numbers to take power. And I do fear that may be the ultimate outcome here. On the nuclear deal, the International Atomic Energy Agency reported earlier this month that Iran is now enriching to 60% enriched uranium, a hair's breadth from weapons grade at their underground facility at Fordo. Outside experts estimate that the time it would take Iran to dash and build nuclear weapons has shrunk almost to zero. So I do fear that the game is almost over here, and the bipartisan effort to stop Iran from building nuclear weapons may have failed.
Dmitry, you were sanctioned by Putin recently. Today, Ukraine is marking 90 years since Stalin imposed a famine that killed 2 to 3 million Ukrainians. What more should the Biden administration be doing? And are you concerned that House Republicans are going to cut off aid to Ukraine?
I don't think the military aid is going to get cut off. And as long as the Ukrainians are able to get ammunition and weapon systems, they're going to keep fighting. They understand that this is an existential struggle for their country. The real problem that we face right now is we're running low on a lot of munitions, the artillery munitions, missiles, javelin missiles that they use for anti-tank strikes. We need to be massively ramping up our production. We need to be building new factories. And the reality is these wars with near-peer competitors like Russia and China can last a long time. And if there is, God forbid, a conflict over Taiwan, we'll run out of things very, very quickly.
And Dmitry, a lot of people missed a key move by the Biden administration regarding export controls and China's chip industry. What's the significance?
Well, this was basically a massive declaration of a trade war against China, basically constraining their ability to produce advanced chips, which are necessary for weapon systems, they're necessary for advanced manufacturing and advanced electronics. And this is something that the Chinese are going to struggle a lot with. They have not been able to achieve independent production, and without ability to procure those chips, this will really impact their military significantly.
Matthew, before we go, what should we expect from the U.S.-Iran World Cup match on Tuesday? We've seen some protests. We've seen the players not sing the national anthem, then sing the national anthem, tears in the stadium. Who's going to win? What's the significance?
Yes. Well, you do have to sympathize with the Iranian players and another act of bravery, refusing to sing the Iranian national anthem as a sign of protest against the regime. So part of me wants to pull with them, but I am a patriot. So USA, USA, USA.
Panel, thank you so much. Up next. Ukrainian refugees use their musical talents to send a message to Vladimir Putin. I'll introduce you to a few of them as they fight back with instruments of peace.
Got the rings?
As we give thanks this weekend, we'd like to remember those facing a long, cold, dark winter in Ukraine, the result of Russia's brutal invasion 9 months ago. The Ukrainian Freedom Orchestra is a truly special ensemble made up of dozens of Ukrainian refugees, musicians who toured Europe and the United States imploring people not to forget. I sat down with a few of the musicians when they visited the Kennedy Center. They fled Ukraine in the hours and days after Russia's invasion, carrying with them a few dollars, their children, and their instruments. Their bows now serve as their weapons as Vladimir Putin's army tries to expunge Ukraine from the map of Europe.
I consider my musicians soldiers of music for a free and independent Ukraine. Putin keeps trying to say there is no culture. We are fighting on the cultural front, and our weapons are our instruments.
Carrie Lynn Wilson assembled 75 Ukrainian refugees who had never played together for an international 12-city tour that ended at the Kennedy Center in the nation's capital.
It came together when I was horrified by the invasion in February. This was very personal for me because I still have family who are in Ukraine. I thought I could somehow bring these refugees together and create an orchestra to give them a voice back, because Putin has silenced them.
You compare your musicians to foot soldiers. People have described you as defiant and artistic resistance.
We're armed with our emotions. We're driven by the fact that we want to prove not only to Putin, but to the world for the future, not only of Ukraine as free and independent country, but for the future of democracy.
Among her soldiers, Olga Shelishkova, the director of Kyiv's Mozart Orchestra, who fled Ukraine with her 16-year-old daughter and cat.
It was dangerous. We can see the rockets on the sky and the sound of explode.
Why is it important for you to be in this orchestra right now?
We have to remind about the war.
Do you feel like a soldier?
I'm a musician.
What is your message to Vladimir Putin?
We are exist. Ukraine is exist. Ukraine is independent country.
Bassist Nazari Stets received special permission from President Zelensky to leave Ukraine. How do you feel right now about the idea of going back to Ukraine?
It's the best thing I can do. I am a professional musician. I think I'm a little bit useless in army, so this is my front. I can play Ukrainian music.
This orchestra has been compared to soldiers.
Yeah.
How are you a soldier?
We can tell the truth to the whole world. I am a soldier because I'm telling the truth and I'm not scared of that.
Those who have chosen to stay in Ukraine, what courage, what bravery, and what determination to stay in their country to fight for its independence.
The pieces she chose to play during the tour all have deep symbolism.
I wanted to feature Ukrainian composers.
Like Valentin Silvestrov, whose Seventh Symphony is dedicated to his wife, who died suddenly.
We dedicate it to the soldiers and the innocent victims of this war. Then I chose Beethoven's Fidelio. It's called Abscheulicher, which means monster. It's about fighting against the tyrant.
Since the invasion on February 24th, the Kennedy Center has bathed itself in the colors of Ukraine's flag.
It was our way of saying, we are watching, we know, we care, we are supporting you.
Ukraine's ambassador thanked the American people.
In this time of tyranny, dictatorship, and total false propaganda, everyone in our global orchestra should feel like an essential instrument, making an important and influential sound. God bless America. И слава Україні.
Each night, the orchestra ends playing Ukraine's national anthem.
There's something very cathartic about playing it, and there's never a dry tear in the audience, and we're crying as we play it in our hearts.
We're proud of our country, proud of our soldier, a real soldier. Brave men who fight.
Really touching all the time. I see the whole audience with Ukrainian flags. So this is a really emotional moment. It's about a bright future.
Your support is very important for us, for Ukrainian people. We feel that we are not alone.
Last month, Carrie Lynn Wilson made her debut at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York with a Russian opera that was banned by Stalin. That's it for this Sunday. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jennifer Griffin. Have a great week, and Shannon will see you next Fox News Sunday when we're live from the Reagan National Defense Forum in Simi Valley, California.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Listen to Fox News Sunday ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.